This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we talk about the insanity defense in our criminal justice system. Attorney and forensic psychologist Susan Vinokur has written a book called Nobody's Child, A Tragedy, A Trial, and a History of the Insanity Defense. We speak with John Bellamy Foster about neo-fascism and President Donald Trump. Professor Foster is the author of Trump in the White House, Tragedy or Farce. Today, he shares his insight about where we may be headed. Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. Public opinion surveys of knowledge, attitudes, and support for the insanity defense show that Americans dislike it. They want insane lawbreakers punished and believe that insanity defense procedures do not protect the public. Polls also reveal that most overestimate the use and the success of the insanity plea. In her book, Nobody's Child, A Tragedy, A Trial, and a History of the Insanity Defense, forensic psychologist and attorney Susan Vinokur tells the story of a 3-year-old child found dead in his mentally ill grandmother's home. Vinokur agreed to evaluate the defendant. She explains how the legal terms competency and insanity do not reflect psychiatric realities, and how in criminal law, the insanity defense too often has been a luxury of the rich and the white. Nobody's Child is an engaging portrait of injustice in the United States and a complex examination of the troubling intersection of mental health and the law. Susan Vinokur is a retired clinical and forensic psychologist. She's also a former prosecutor and a former associate professor of psychiatry at the University of Rochester School of Medicine. Susan, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much.
And congratulations on really an incredible book, Nobody's Child. Susan, let's start by a brief overview of the facts of the central case in your book, that of Dorothy Dunn and little Ramey. What happened?
Dorothy was a woman who had 5 children. Her oldest, Heaven My Love, had several children also, but her oldest child, Heaven My Love, was the mother of the little boy featured in this case. His name was Ramey. And when he was 3 years old, he was placed with Dorothy Dunn, his grandmother, because his mother was schizophrenic and drug addicted and homeless. She was working as a prostitute and working for drugs. And so he was in a dangerous, totally unstable situation. And his grandmother, Dorothy Dunn, had taken care of him often throughout his life anyway. So Child Protective Services brought Ramey to Dorothy. But Dorothy was in a bad way. She was depressed. She was exhausted. Her father had recently died. Several of her own young children had multiple needs and special issues. And she told the protective worker that she couldn't take Ramey, that she couldn't make a good home for him right then. And the protective worker basically said, well, he's your responsibility, and dropped him off and walked away. 6 months later, nobody had come back to see how they were doing. And Dorothy called 911 to report that he had fallen. And so the 9/11 first responders rushed to the house, and they found him laying on the kitchen floor with a significant head injury, and he was clearly dead and had been dead 4 days at that point. And he had some other injuries that were suggestive that maybe there had been some abuse. So Dorothy was arrested and charged with second-degree murder. She was charged with abusing him and starving him and causing this head injury. And then the issue came up that she clearly had some sort of psychiatric disability or intellectual disability. She had moved this little boy's body off and on a heating grate for 3 days after his death to keep him warm so he felt alive. She had slept with his corpse for 3 days. And she really wasn't able to be interviewed by the public defender with any coherence. And so I was called into the case to do a psychiatric evaluation.
When I read this book, Susan, I was struck at the outset with Dorothy's condition, a numbness that she seemed to evince, perhaps a lack of understanding about what was happening. What is the legal standard for the insanity defense?
Well, you're legally insane if you don't know what you're doing and don't know that it's wrong. And that sounds fairly easy to apply, but the way the courts have actually interpreted it, it means that you can have a psychotic delusion and be completely irrational and out of control of your behavior and still be labeled sane if you know that what you're doing is generally legally wrong. So, for example, if I know that I have killed a man and I know that killing is generally wrong, I'm sane, even though I thought that man was an embodiment of the Antichrist spreading a pandemic throughout the world and the only way to save humanity was to kill him. So I know what I did is legally wrong, but I think it's morally right because I'm delusional. Well, I'm sane.
You mention in the book that a few states recognize extreme emotional disturbance as an insanity defense. Can you explain what that is?
Yeah, it's not really an insanity defense, but it's in mitigation of guilt. And so there are a few states that recognize that when a person has experienced a severe trauma, the kind of trauma that the ordinary person would have an overwhelming response to, and when they do something that's illegal because of that response, like killing a person, if they're in that overwhelmed mental state at the time they do it, then their guilt is going to be of a lower level. So, for example, rather than first-degree murder, it might be second-degree murder or an intentional homicide. I had a case years ago where a man was told by his wife that their 3-year-old daughter had been sexually molested repeatedly by the next-door neighbor. And he was so upset by that that he blindly grabbed a kitchen knife, ran across to the neighbor's house, burst into his house, and stabbed him 37 times and killed him. Well, the state psychiatrist said he was laboring under an extreme emotional disturbance and shouldn't be tried for first-degree murder, only for second-degree. So it isn't the same as the insanity defense, but there's a relationship.
It's sort of like in the heat of the moment, a spouse comes home and finds his wife or she finds husband with someone else and acts out in response. There's no planning.
Right. And sometimes it's called irresistible impulse. But right, the initial trauma needs to be one that's really out of the ordinary. So 50 years ago, finding your wife in bed with another man was sufficient to raise the issue of irresistible impulse. Today, apparently, it's thought to be more common and not such a huge trauma, so it has to be something bigger.
Oh, that's interesting. I didn't know that.
If it's something really big, like an attack on your child, for example, or the death of a spouse
right.
through a violent act. Yeah, but there aren't too many states that have that defense, actually.
Now, why doesn't the public in general like the insanity defense? Do high-profile cases impact public opinion? I'm thinking, for example, of the case of John Hinckley Jr.
Well, that's a great question. Why don't they like it, indeed? I think in individual cases, they can understand that a person can be so out of their mind, so irrational because of mental illness, that they could do something that they shouldn't be held responsible for as if they were in their ordinary, normal state of mind. But when it comes down to individual cases where you have an actual victim, I think juries are really hesitant to not hold somebody accountable. Part of it is their worry that anybody can feign insanity and get off when really they weren't insane. Part of it is a distrust for mental health testimony, but part of it also is an urge toward retribution. So when the act that was done was really heinous and horrific, you know, there's a groundswell of feeling in the media, in the public, and in jurors to not let a person escape accountability for that. And certainly that was true in the Hinckley case. He was found not guilty by reason of insanity, and there was quite a backlash against that. And the insanity defense was further restricted and tightened in almost all states, and some states abolished it altogether.
I was going to ask about that. So there are a handful of states that don't allow you to raise this in court.
Right. Right. They may let you raise it at the sentencing phase, but the issue of guilt is going to be decided irrespective of your mental status. There are about four states that do that. That's okay for a state to abolish the insanity defense and the defense.
Now, how often is this defense raised in court? I was surprised. You cited a statistic of a decade of over 5,000 murder cases in New York, where only 43 of the defendants pled the insanity, and of those, only a few were found not guilty by reason of insanity. Is it because the standard's so difficult to meet?
I think so. Generally, only about 1% of all felony cases raise an insanity defense, and only about a quarter of those succeed. And so, it's partly because the standard is so hard to meet. The legal definition of insanity bears no relationship to any psychiatric diagnosis. So a person can be severely mentally ill without any question, but not qualify for legal insanity. Part of it is that we have a lot of defendants who are represented by public defenders, and public defenders generally have terribly high caseloads and very limited budgets for things like investigation and psychiatric defenses. And attorneys generally have no training whatever in mental health issues or psychology or psychiatry. So when you figure that they are unprepared to understand the issues, unable to investigate them and get a good evaluation, and know that the court and juries are generally negative in their response anyway, the tendency is to use the limited psychiatric data to try to get a plea to a reduced charge rather than to actually raise the defense.
Let's go back for a minute to the case of Dorothy Dunn and Little Ramey that is really beautifully described in your book, albeit heartbreaking. One of your preliminary tasks, I understand, was to determine if Dunn was fit to stand trial. And how do you do that?
Right. The first question when somebody has psychiatric issues is to determine if they're competent to stand trial. And competency just means, in legal terms, that they are able to consult with their attorney to prepare a defense. So it's a very, very low standard. As long as they understand that they're being charged with a crime, that they have an attorney to represent them, and that they can give some semi-coherent story accounting for themselves so that the attorney can begin to defend them, they're held competent. So even if they're crazy, you know, in colloquial terms, or very intellectually limited, for example, they're still most likely going to be held competent.
And Dorothy was, in your estimation, competent?
Yes, I thought that she was, that she would meet the standard for competence, even though as a human being, as I looked at her, I sure wouldn't have wanted to be in her shoes in terms of competence. In other words, she was going to be very limited in her ability to interact with her attorney or to give a coherent accounting of herself, but enough that I thought she met the legal standard and would be held competent.
A line from your book goes, and I quote, "The law regarding the insanity defense has often blown with the prevailing political winds, rather than adhering to its original ethical and moral roots." Can you talk briefly about that?
Yeah, in the beginning, and by in the beginning, I mean back in the time of the ancient Hebrews or the classical Romans or Greeks, there was always an exception made for people who were not in their right mind. And it was thought that they should not be punished for their acts, that they were ill and not rational. And over time, it evolved, you know, the court continued to struggle with, well, how do we know when we're seeing that kind of insanity? Who qualifies for that? And they tried to codify it. And it was going along with the idea that a person had to know what they were doing, and also they had to know that it was not only legally wrong, but also morally wrong. And if they knew that what they were doing was morally wrong, then they were sane enough, and they should be held guilty, and they should be punished. Well, a Scottish woodcutter named Daniel McNaughton came along during the reign of Queen Victoria and tried to assassinate the prime minister. And in doing so, he actually killed somebody else accidentally. But he was tried for murder, and he was found not guilty by reason of insanity because he had powerful psychotic delusions and was irrational. Queen Victoria was incensed by this. She thought everybody ought to be held accountable, that otherwise every Tom, Dick, and Harry is going to try to commit murder and say they're insane and they won't be deterred. So she wanted to see everyone held accountable and punished. And she asked the House of Lords to convene a panel of judges to examine what legal insanity should be. And they came up with a highly more restrictive definition that fewer people would qualify for. And that was about 200 years ago, and that's what has come forward into the courts in the United States. When Charles Guiteau assassinated President Garfield, the restrictions became even tighter. And when John Hinckley tried to assassinate Reagan, again, the definition was further restricted and, as I said, dropped entirely in some states.
Susan, talk, if you will, a bit about Child Protective Services and the role that they played in the Dorothy Dunn case. You write that in a 2018 review of Child Protective Services, only in one case of three did their investigators dig deeply enough into family histories and circumstances to analyze the likelihood of future maltreatment. Now, I would think that would be at the crux of their duties.
Yes, that is the crux of their duties, is to accept reports and do enough of an investigation to determine if there's a level of danger that requires intervention. The problems are mostly financial. Most Child Protective Services programs are very inadequately funded. So there aren't enough protective services workers, and they're paid so poorly that they burn out quickly before they really have experience and perspective. And so they're in kind of an impossible situation. They can't really monitor all the cases they have. They often are kind of junior people who are only learning how to do a decent investigation or learning about the population of children that they're investigating. And so a great many cases are missed, and a lot of mistakes are made with tragic results. Children are remaining in homes where they're eventually killed or permanently disabled, or they're being temporarily taken out and then returned to the home where they're killed or disabled. And this has been going on, you know, for 40 years because we apparently would rather fund prisons than Child Protective Service worker slots. So in the case of Dorothy Dunn, she herself as a child received severe abuse. Department of Social Services never provided any kind of protection or respite for her. And when Ramey started having some injuries that brought up the question of whether there was abuse, several Child Protective Services people were in a position to have discovered that and followed up on it, but they did not. And, of course, the final insult was when the protective service worker left Ramey on her doorstep when she was pleading with him not to and saying that it was too much for her and she couldn't handle it. And then he never came back. 6 months later, he had never checked in to see how that child was. And in fact, when he took Ramey to her, knowing that the child had been in the hands of a homeless, psychotic, drug-addicted mother, He didn't even roll up this child's sleeves to see if he had any marks on him. He didn't weigh him to see if he had failure to thrive. He basically did nothing and just dropped the child off. So this is definitely a death that could have been prevented and should have been prevented.
We're not going to give away the outcome of the book, but could you talk briefly about the social worker's log, the one who evaluated Ms. Dunn? The notes apparently said, quote, "I advised her she had to do whatever it takes," after Dorothy told the social worker she didn't want to hurt her children. What was the importance of that line?
Yes, well, Dorothy had a son who was about 15 years older than Remy. She also had a son who was 2 years older than Remy, so her family stretched out over some time. But when her own son was growing up, he became quite a handful. He was very aggressive. He was very defiant. He was bullying people in the neighborhood and in the home. And the school had called Child Protective to see if there were preventive services that might help Dorothy. And the child protective worker came to the house and looked at the situation and asked Dorothy how she disciplined him when he was misbehaving. And Dorothy said, well, she generally hit him with the end of a broom, with the broom straw end of the broom, and that all that did was make him laugh. It didn't change his behavior. So the protective worker told her she had to do whatever it took to get control over his behavior, and that meant not just hitting him with the soft end of a broom. Well, Dorothy has an IQ of about 75. She barely got through third grade. She really didn't know anything about child development. She didn't know anything about how to discipline a child appropriately, since she herself had been handled very harshly and had been abused. She did not want to hurt her child. She didn't want to cause pain. But she took this as an authority telling her that that was her responsibility and that she was being derelict and negligent if she didn't do it. So she began disciplining her children more physically, swatting them and hitting them with electrical cords and hangers, things like that, things that other people in her neighborhood also routinely did. And this was her attempt to be a good mother and to keep her children from going down a bad path. That she thought she'd been advised that she should do that and was supposed to do that.
And I think our listeners will want to read this compelling book to find out more about how that one sentence fit into the larger picture. We have just a few minutes left. I wanted to ask you, Susan, if you don't mind, how did you get interested in this field?
Well, I had a circuitous route, like a lot of people did. I initially practiced law because I was interested in child protection. I was interested in children who are in difficult family situations having some visibility and some support and protection. I had myself grown up in a family where there was abuse, and it was a family, upper middle class. It flew under the radar. You know, there weren't social services involved with the family. It looked like a perfect family with a white picket fence and singing in the choir. So no one realized that the abuse was occurring and no one offered any help. So I started out in law, practicing family law and child protection. And then I realized that no matter how carefully you prepare a case, the end result is that the court issues an order. Well, abusive parents or mentally ill parents are not going to be able to follow an order simply because it came out of a judge's mouth. They're going to need a lot more help and support and supervision than that. So I went back and I got a PhD in clinical psychology, and from there into clinical and forensic psychology. So that was my route.
Before we leave, I want to ask you if there are one or two myths floating around about the insanity defense, what would you say to our listeners to dispel those myths?
Well, I think one of the most prevalent myths is that anybody can feign mental illness and fake an insanity defense and just get off scot-free. That doesn't happen, and it pretty much can't happen. And I think the second myth is that the legal definition of insanity has some psychiatric validity. It does not. There's no psychiatric correlate. nobody is mentally ill in the way that the law talks about. And a great number of people who are truly psychotic and do not have any understanding of their behavior are convicted and sometimes subjected to the death penalty. So we need to revise our definition of insanity.
Susan, one of our frequent guests on Law and Disorder is David Cole, and I just want to read a sentence from the book jacket. He writes about your book, Nobody's Child, quote, a deeply moving tale of what happens when we, in quotation marks, treat severe poverty and mental illness through the criminal justice system. And we have to agree, you've done really a beautiful job of telling a heartbreaking story that illuminates the many problems in our criminal justice system. Thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder, and we wish you all the best with this book and with your important work.
Oh, thank you, Heidi. It's been a pleasure speaking with you.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Start understanding Trump and Trumpism is to accurately define what he represents. Mainstream liberal commentators refuse to associate the Trump phenomena with fascism, calling him a right-wing populist or a nationalist. But it matters what Trump is called if we are to fashion a resistance to him. Analysts on the left, like Noam Chomsky, Chris Hedges, and Cornel West, understand that Trump and the constellation of forces that make up his movement, principally big business and white non-college educated middle-class persons, are fascists. The poet, playwright, and political thinker Bertolt Brecht was asked about German fascism in 1935. How can anyone tell the truth about fascism, he replied, unless he is willing to speak out against capitalism, which brings it forth? It was a failure of a united socialist movement in Germany in the early 30s that allowed Hitler to gain power. We've seen with the Bernie Sanders phenomenon the possibilities of building a socialist movement in the United States. Joining us today is John Bellamy Foster, professor of sociology at the University of Oregon and the editor of the venerable independent socialist magazine Monthly Review. Professor Foster is also the author of Trump in the White House, Tragedy or Farce. John, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
I'm glad to be back.
What, John, is the relationship between fascism and big business here and now in the United States?
Well, fascism, or I call it neo-fascism, it's part of what we call generically fascism, which has a lot of different types. But the classically fascism has to do with an alliance between big business, the very top of the capitalist class, or elements of it, traditionally monopoly capital, and the lower middle class, which is brought in as a kind of a rear guard of the system when there are major conflicts and contradictions. And so neo-fascism, like fascism, is very much dependent on support from monopoly finance capital, from elements of the billionaire class, as Sanders calls it, and they're feeding money into the lower middle class, which tends to be quite reactionary and nationalistic, and particularly in this time. This is the basis of, say, the Trump political alliance.
Can you describe the conditions that make it ripe for the neo-fascism movement to develop here in the U.S.?
Well, one thing is that the system is unstable in the sense that we have the greatest inequality developing in the history of the world. I mean, 3 billionaires in the United States have as much wealth as half the population. But if you look at, say, just at recent events, the wealth of the billionaires in the United States increased by $282 billion since the pandemic started. In the last month, their wealth has increased by $282 billion, which is more than the total wealth of all the billionaires in the United States in 1990. So you're seeing a vast centralization of wealth and inequality. It makes the entire system unstable and is driving it in a rightward direction. But there's also a bigger issue is economic stagnation. The United States has been having slow growth, about 2% for a long time now. And you have a loss of U.S. economic hegemony in the world, which affects those at the top enormously. So you have China's growing at about 7% a year, which means their economy doubles in size every 10 years. And the U.S. economy is growing at about 2%, which means its economy doubles in about 35 years. And it's not, the writing is on the wall now. The U.S. power in the world is diminishing, and the multinational corporations and U.S. finance, the entire imperial system depends on that. Meanwhile, you have kind of the slowdown stagnation in the United States. You find that there was a bit of what we call a labor aristocracy, a segment of the working class that benefited from the U.S. position in the world and is now seeing its power diminish, more privileged sector of the working class. And, of course, the lower middle class is really experiencing that. So this has turned those groups, particularly the lower middle class, in a far more reactionary direction. And, of course, the United States has a long legacy of slavery and the effects of slavery, and there's a native reaction at the base of U.S. society. So all of these things are coming together. The whole political system is moving to the right, not just the Republicans who are now under Trump's thumb, but also the Democrats.
Well, let's talk about Donald Trump's assault on the liberal democratic state. What has become of an independent judiciary, the separation of powers known as checks and balances over the last few years?
I think it's diminished enormously. One other thing about when you're talking about a political structure or political movement of fascist type, and I think of it as a political alliance because it's really motivated by the rich, but the army of that makes it work comes from the lower middle class. Creating this kind of political bloc, they're able to attack the liberal democratic state. When you see a movement of the fascist type or neo-fascism, you're talking about a version of the capitalist state that sees the liberal democratic state with its separation of powers in particular as the enemy and tries to concentrate the power in the state much more. And what we've seen is the Supreme Court is now packed by the Trump interests, and you can see this in recent decisions. The courts are being packed. The courts are no longer exercising the kind of check on the executive. More and more power is being assumed by the executive and by the White House. And, of course, the Republican Party controls the Senate. So what we have is a situation that's ideal for those who want to shift the system to the right. And, of course, the billionaires, there are now 620 in the 29 in the United States and have been exerting their out-of-proportion political and economic force to shift the system as well.
As soon as Trump took over the White House, he moved to consolidate his power and to bring in line aspects of the government, including state governments and the Washington bureaucracy, and also the media. How effective has he been in that?
My book, Trump in the White House, which came out in 2017, really dealt with the first 100 days of the Trump administration, which could be called the Bannon period, which was the most radical right stage of his administration, where they went at the media with hammer and tongs, and it was dramatic. They instituted what in German was called Gleichschaltung, bringing into line an approach of, you know, basically bringing into line the media, educational institutions, Congress, the deep state, or the intelligence community, the military, and so on. They tried to bring them all in a line. And while there was resistance, they basically succeeded in that period in shifting the political norms enormously. Bannon left, and there was a period where there was more of a neoliberal, neo-fascist alliance. And now I think the Trump administration is on the being aggressive again and basically trying to triumph over the neoliberal elements within the capitalist class and concentrate power in the state around the president much more. And it's very ominous, and I think a lot of things are happening in this context of this crisis that people aren't noticing, that a really shift of power in a lot of areas where when everyone's guard is down.
Clarify, if you will, for us, how is Trump viewed by his followers?
Well, basically what he says goes. He lies, and everyone knows he lies, but it's like carrying the flag. What he says is true, even if it's a lie. It's amazing. I look at Breitbart a lot, which is probably the closest politically to Trump and influences him. And it's amazing how they simply fall in line. If the lie becomes the truth, in Germany, there was something they called the Führer principle that was actually people like Carl Schmitt treated it as a legal principle. But the notion that the leader is correct, and we follow his line, it almost becomes a badge of honor. And people wear the MAGA hats, and it's very much of a drumbeat, the walk in lockstep to some extent.
So would you say that the so-called Trump phenomenon is not simply about Trump?
Trump is just sort of the instrument of it, very unusual instrument, but he came along when it was ripe for this kind of political alliance with the lower middle class, the white lower middle class, it's almost entirely white, outraged, becoming more nationalistic, concerned about loss of U.S. hegemony. Trump represented sort of an attitude of a detente with Russia, which developed within this political movement before him, and putting all of the U.S. military imperial force at stopping China. And that's what we see. But all these things emerged in the movement prior to Trump. He didn't create any of it. He simply was able to grab onto it, and he had good teachers. And so, we call the Trump phenomenon sometimes, but it isn't really about Trump. He's simply an instrument, and if he were to go away, this phenomenon would still be there. It's a political alliance that's now very deeply embedded in American politics.
John, can you talk about the relationship between Christian evangelicals and Trump's neo-fascist movement, especially if you could talk about the irrationality in the denial of science that we see on display really daily?
I think that the evangelicism has always been part of, it's intrinsic in the right in the United States. Neo-fascist movements have always exploited right-wing Christian tendencies. Fascist movements historically drawn on these. So it's not surprising. It's part of the entire web here. The evangelical aspect gives more force to it. It organizes the right. I don't really see it as all that separate today. They're very much interwoven. The evangelical movement has a basis in the same class, basically lower middle class, privileged elements of the working class, the Trump politics that the neo-fascism is based in. You wouldn't see much of a change if Trump was replaced by Pence. It's the same political formation.
What is the relationship, both historically and now, between fascism and violence and fascism and the rule of law?
Well, fascism is an attack on the liberal democratic state, which has been the primary political formation in the developed capitalist states for most of their history. But every time liberalism often goes into crisis and those in power want to preserve the capitalist state, they go after the liberal aspects of the state and turn it more towards the right, towards their interests. Neoliberalism is already a twist in that direction. So what happens is that, the original idea of totalitarianism, which was developed in Nazi Germany, was the notion of total power within the state. They privatized the economy. The concept of privatization actually originated in Nazi Germany. They privatized the economy, increased the power of monopoly capital, concentrated capital, and at the same time they centralized power in the state. And what was the checks and balances of the Weimar Republic were basically eliminated. The legislature, Congress, their legislature was reduced to simply controlled by the executive power to the extent that it continued to exist. The courts continued to exist, but follow the principle of the leader. What we see in that's going on with the courts now is Trump is overstepping all sorts of boundaries, and the courts go along with it. And so the courts are supporting this right-wing shift. We don't really have a functional liberal democratic state anymore, and that's one of the chief problems.
Let's talk about the COVID-19 pandemic for a minute. Please discuss how Trump is using this as a cover to suspend environmental regulations, put military pressure on Venezuela, and anything else he's trying to get in.
Well, he's doing all of those things. So the military pressure on Venezuela has increased. The EPA has suspended environmental laws, for example, regulation of pollution of water. It's tried to promote oil leases. It's basically been giving these away with the environmental movement inactive in this period. It's not very succeeding in the oil sector, though. The U.S. Oil industry, the tight oil industry, is collapsing, not just because of COVID-19, but because of the overproduction of oil in the United States, the flooding of the world market, and the actions that Saudi Arabia and Russia took in response. The U.S. tight oil industry is just collapsing right now. And this is a very big problem for Trump, but he's doing everything he can to pour money into the oil sector. And all of this is going on behind the scenes during COVID-19. Another issue is he put Peter Navarro, who I talk about, and Trump in the White House, who is the economist that he put in charge of the trade war in China. And Navarro has wanted war, not just economic war, but military war with China for a long time. He put Navarro in charge of the trade war with China to pull U.S. commodity chains out of China in the context of the COVID-19 crisis. He put Navarro in charge of the Defense Production Act. And Navarro has been using this to promote the idea that there was a China shock, a China virus, and that we have to essentially have an increased economic war against China and maybe beyond that in response to COVID-19. And this is very, very big on the Republican side now. It's also big on the Democrats. Biden has recognized this, and so both Trump and the Biden campaign are now playing on who is going to be the most xenophobic towards China.
Speaking of Biden and the elections that are on many people's minds coming up, we have essentially a leaderless socialist movement. And Biden's the only opposition to Trump. Do you have any predictions about what might unravel?
I think the socialist movement is in a serious crisis because of the elections. There are a lot of Sanders supporters and some of the publications, like Nation, Jacobin, and so on, are basically saying that the whole movement has to endorse Biden. Others in the DSA, I think a large part of the movement will not want to do that and will refuse to do that. So there's a real conflict among the Sanders supporters now that Sanders has endorsed Biden. But the reality is that Biden is going to shift towards the right. He's going to play for right-wing voters, for the lower middle class. He's going to be more nationalistic, and he thinks, hopes he has the majority of the working class already in his box. to the extent that they vote, and he's going to fight for the lower middle class. He's going to become more nationalistic. This is part of his whole history as a politician. He's always steered things to the right. So we'll see him fighting for the lower middle class voters and becoming more nationalistic. The Trump strategy will be to combine that kind of national populism, his neo-fascism, with appeals to a section of the working class by basically promoting their interests via trade wars and so on, or supposedly promoting their interests. So I think that at this state, the Trump political formation or the Trump political movement has the upper hand over the Democrats. The Democrats don't really know what to do except to steer further to the right. And the socialist movement that arose under Sanders is just going to be ignored by the Biden campaign until it gets very close to the election, and then they always appeal to the left to get them to come out and vote. They appeal to the working class at the very end to get them to vote, but most of the campaign will steer right, you know, to the right. And it's a real trap for the American population, and people have to find a way not to play along.
John, in our remaining couple of minutes, we'd like to end on a slightly positive note. Under what circumstances can we be hopeful about the future?
Well, a lot of things have changed. People, and I found this with my students, they said nothing can ever change. They said things are just the way they are. They won't change at all. I remember this like 2 weeks before the pandemic, I was teaching a class, and the students said, well, nothing could change. And I said, well, the United States is approaching another financial crisis. There's been an excessive surge. A bubble has been developing that we have economic stagnation. We're headed towards the economic crisis this way. U.S. hegemony is going down, and the ecological crisis is much worse, and there's going to be all sorts of unexpected developments. And I mentioned the growth of, you know, epidemics and pandemics, and because we'd been watching that. And 2 weeks later, all this stuff started happening at one time, and the students were really surprised. And suddenly everybody has to go into social distancing, and the economy goes down. We stop burning so much fossil fuel, so much that they have floods of fossil fuel they don't know what to do with. The air pollution goes away. The skies are clear again all over the world. And what it does is show us that there are all sorts of possibilities, that things can change, that we can do different things, that it opens up people's imagination. And everyone knows now that Medicare for all is necessary. And socialism is going to be even more on people's minds because the capitalist system has failed. Right now, they seem to have us in a hammer lock, but the truth is that the movements for change, for really decisive change at the bottom, are growing, and people's sense of a future that's different is growing all the time, the necessity of it and the possibility of it. So I ended an interview that I just did. The left used to say, often says, that it's easier to imagine the end of the world than the end of capitalism. I think that's changed now. I think it's easier to imagine the end of capitalism than the end of the world, because we've woken up to the nature of the problem, and people are going to be on the move again.
Well said. I think it's certainly true that the pandemic, as frustrating and tragic as it has been for so many, has also opened up, as you say, people's imagination about what life could look like. John, we have run out of time. Thank you so much for joining us once again on Law and Disorder, and we look forward to staying in touch.
thank you so much for having me, and maybe people could look at Trump in the White House and get a fuller view of what we were talking about.
Yes, we will definitely put a link to your book on the website. Thank you so much, John.
Thank you.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.